What's up, y'all? It's your boy Rylan Godey. Welcome back to the Name of the Dog podcast. Once again, I'm your host, Rylan Godey. We got three special guests with me here today in the studio. Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
I'm Audrey Hughes.
Jack Casey.
I'm Wynn Andrews.
Got a great crowd with us today. So we are going to hit on two different topics. We're going to go ahead and kick it off with the migration of lacrosse kind of from the northern part of the United States to the south. Wynn, go ahead and hit on that a little bit for us.
Absolutely, Rylan. So Jack and I have been able to really do extensive research this semester going into a lot of just why women's lacrosse is becoming so significant here in the South after really gaining momentum up in the North. It's not necessarily the biggest sport that we hear of in the South, but I think it's starting to gain some traction, Jack. You know, we've talked about it a lot. It is a sport that continues to grow in popularity among its members from the K through 12 level into college, yet I don't feel like it's really, you know, gathering the momentum and the coverage that it deserves to, as it is such a trending sport. I was actually able to cover Delaney Ott, who is a goalie here at the University of Georgia Women's Lacrosse Club team, and she is just a great role model for all of those girls. But she actually was originally from Maryland, which is obviously a huge lacrosse hub just in general for a lot of, you know, very successful women's high school teams. She was originally committed to Jacksonville University, and then decided that she really wanted to do something else, and that was go to an SEC school. That was originally her motivation behind attending the University of Georgia. And while, you know, she really wanted to have that club, she really wanted to have original competition in a varsity sport, she decided to go with UGA instead because she said that it was just such a well balance between student life and athlete life as well.
Yeah, very similar to Delaney. I covered a young woman named Caitlin Sparks. She is originally from Connecticut. Went out to California to originally play at the D3 level, but attended school during COVID and wasn't really a great place to be, according to her. So she was looking for a more balanced sports and life and school situation. So she came down to Georgia, wanted to go to a big football school in the SEC, and found the club women's lacrosse team, and it's been a good balance for her ever since.
Yeah, so Delaney Ott and Caitlin Sparks, both back-to-back, two students for the University of Georgia who originally hail from the North, coming down to play here in Athens for the club lacrosse team. And they actually just were runners-up in the Women's Club Lacrosse Association. That's a long...
Say that 10 times over.
Yeah, tell you what.
In the championship against Boston College this past spring, a huge game there. We've heard plenty about that from Delaney and Caitlin. That's for another time. However, funny enough, the two that we have been able to interview, Delaney Ott is the club president for the women's lacrosse team, followed by Caitlin Sparks, the vice president.
The one-two punch.
Right. They have been very successful in the past, and they continue to show that. And the, you know, the issue of popularity, with they continue to gain steam, really brings up the idea of, do you think that the women's club lacrosse team could be a varsity sport? And that is something that we've discussed a lot of. And obviously for, you know, universities across the country, Title IX is the set of rules that have been put into place, or I guess the opportunity that's been put in place. And with that, they release a three-tracted state of rules for colleges to demonstrate that they are offering these participation opportunities.
Yeah, this part can get kind of confusing, so you might want to pay attention on the three rules.
Lean up in your seats.
Yeah.
Open those ears.
Get ready. Buckle up.
So here we go. Let's make sure, you know, Jack, check behind me real quick. We're going to make sure. Number one, we have to make sure that the number of female athletes is substantially proportionate, quote unquote, to the number of female undergraduate students. Number two, the department has a history and continuing practice of expanding opportunities for women. Last but not least, the department needs to be able to demonstrate that it is fully and effectively accommodating interests and abilities of female students on campus.
So let's go back through these three real quick. So number one, basically that's saying the percentage, read that again for me.
The number of female students needs to be substantially proportionate to the number of students on campus. So for example,
female student athletes.
Okay. Yeah.
So for example, if we're trying to say that 55% of students on campus are female, then 55% of athletes should be female as well.
Okay. So making sure the female student-athlete population mirrors that of the female population student. Okay.
So hearing those three rules, I want to ask you guys, from hearing those, do you think that UGA follows all three of those? Just
no.
Broadly?
No.
Okay, what's your general perception of that? Why not?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. Like, I think there are a lot of smaller sports that are female-dominated at the University of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I mean, equestrian, it seems like, is I mean, I haven't done enough research on it, so I have no idea. But
well, funny that you mentioned the equestrian team, because, you know, in the second rule, which is going to emphasize that the department continues to have expanded opportunities for women athletes, the University of Georgia last added the equestrian team as a women's varsity sport. Do you know when that year was when they added it?
I don't know. 2001.
2001.
No way.
Yeah. Right on the money, Ryland.
I was going to try that for our listeners.
At first, I was like, you're close, but I was trying to trick him. He was spot on. That's
right. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So obviously not meeting one of the three requirements, followed by the fact that when we talk about the first rule, we were just talking about the proportions of female athletes. 58% of UGA's student athletes are female, and only 50% of the student athletes are female.
So it's an 8%.
8% difference, so it's obviously higher than the department's benchmark. That's 5 percentage points. That's a huge, pretty big difference.
I actually had the chance to talk to Donna Lopiano, I hope I'm saying her last name correctly. Talked to her about 15 minutes. Dr. Suggs actually got me in touch with her. She's the founder of the Women's Sports Foundation, and she's a longtime advocate for Title IX. This is what she had to say in regards to what the athletic department should be inclined to do when it comes to female athletic participation.
The athletic department has an obligation to do it themselves. They do not wait for anybody to ask. It is their obligation to, every year they're not in compliance with proportionality, they must assess whether or not there's interest and ability out there to add another women's team.
So to play devil's advocate here for a second, and not to say this is anything that I believe, I'm just kind of pushing it out a little bit. So the rule says that it has to be proportionate to the amount of female students on campus, correct?
Correct.
So
the benchmark is 5 percentage points. UGA is at 8, so that's technically 3 percentage points over where they need to be.
So why not 50-50? Like, why not just go, these are going to be our male sports, these are going to be our female sports, they're going to be 50-50.
Like ignoring student population?
Yes.
I mean, I feel like revenue has to do a lot with that. There are a lot of male sports that bring in a lot more money than any of these female sports. We did it in one of our research, you know, all the sports that we looked into. I did women's gymnastics, and they were losing money in a lot of the sports. Football is the only one that really brings in money.
Well, that's what I was about to say, was not even just female sports losing money. Almost all of them do, male or female, except football and maybe basketball, depending on your school.
Mm-hmm. So here, that begs the question, how does the revenue of each sport, how does that affect small sports, do you think? Like for us, football is the only product, like it only is the only sport that produces money for the school. So how do you think that affects adding smaller sports for women when you know they're going to lose money?
What are you referring to them being like less inclined to do so because it's just guaranteed losing money?
You think that happens?
You can see both sides of it. I think that having more sports, both male and female, makes students want to come to school, first of all, because if the only sport here was football, granted, national champions, all that, football very successful, but variation of sport and being able to go to a baseball game or a basketball game or gymnastics meet or whatever, they like to have options as a student body, I think, personally, at least.
I agree with that.
I think that's where they kind of, I mean, I know athletics and the academics side of school are obviously a little bit separate when it comes to things like this, but they make their money back through tuition in a weird mm-hmm. way, not directly, obviously, but they make up for it.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of out-of-state students and their tuition definitely does cover. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a majority of the university is on Hope or Zell scholarship because it's a big in-state school, and that definitely plays a part into how much money they get from out-of-state students.
Looking back on the three-part test, you know, we've just went through a bunch of numbers and rules number one and two. We've completely left out part three, and that is actually the one that is most general. And then it just says, part three of the test is requiring full and effective accommodation of the interests and abilities of female students. So let's think back to the women's lacrosse team. Those who probably, there's many on the team that we've spoken with who are happy where they are right now, but they obviously want a little bit more, you know, attention. You know, there needs to be a lot more media attention given towards the team that continues just to, you know, push barriers year after year, you know, going back to the playoffs year after year, just so much success on that team. So their success alone, I feel, demonstrates that there is plenty of interest and ability on campus to do something about that, yet they still remain a club sport. So therefore, I mean, I think that UGA is really lacking in a lot of those areas.
Well, I think you can look to pro sports as well for a comparison, with the men's making it to the men's U.S. national team, making it into the elimination stage of the tournament, did you guys see that they made $12 million just for making it, and half of that went to the women's team?
Yeah.
It was the first time they've ever done that. And the $6.4 million they gave to the women's team was more than the women's team earned in both years of their winning the World Cup.
Wow.
So that's kind of a demonstration of we should maybe start looking into something like that when, you know, football or when the men's equivalent earns something, kind of split it down to the women's. Mm-hmm. I think that'd be kind of interesting.
Well, we talked plenty about, you know, women's lacrosse, the success that they are around at Bradley. I know you've been covering men's lacrosse. Where does it like on that side of the field?
Yeah, so what's interesting is you talk about kind of the migration from north to south, and one of the draws for men's lacrosse to the southern part of the United States for colleges is the lesser of competition. So up north, think of it as your SEC of football, but for SEC of lacrosse is up north, right? And so those are the schools that are going to get the elite players and the
your
top
Maryland's,
of top.
Your John Hopkins,
yes,
your,
yes, okay. Your big times. And so what a lot of players want to do is they want to come down to, let's say, a Mercer, who's the only D1 lacrosse team in Georgia, and be the dude. And so when I talked to the Reinhardt head coach, they're an NAIA school, and they've won back-to-back-to-back-to-back, so four times NAIA championships.
Wow. That's amazing.
One of the things he says is guys up there might be the lowest guy on the totem pole getting a 1% scholarship when you can come down here, be the top man, and I can give you 50% scholarship.
Right.
And so one of the draws for people coming down south for men's lacrosse is money and competition. And one little stat that I found on this website called Athlete Group was lacrosse in the last 15 years at the D1 level has grown 61% in 15 years. Which is actually pretty crazy when you think
just
about it.
Overall D1 level?
Overall.
Like country, the entire nation? Wow.
The amount of D1 varsity teams that have been added was 61% improved from 2000. I think it was the study was from 2018 compared to 2003. So that adds a pretty cool.
And do you think a majority of that is leaving the Northeast region and those schools making teams? Like, obviously, that's the biggest part of that growth.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, the reason is a lot of younger kids are starting to play as well. I know at my high school, it became a sport, a varsity sport, 9 years ago.
Yeah, we played y'all a couple times.
Yeah. And and so, you know, one of my buddies who actually plays up in Michigan now for lacrosse on a varsity team says that a lot of those guys that live in local or in the area had opportunities to come down to Georgia and almost did. And so I definitely think that that plays a factor into it.
So I don't want to ask too vague of a question right now, but we're focusing right now on men's and women's lacrosse at the club level. Where do we see this going, continuing the popularity just continues to surge in numbers year after year in Georgia?
I mean, I think it kind of originates, at least recently, more at the elementary and, like, smaller kid level. Mm-hmm. My sister plays lacrosse, and she's committed to go play Division I. And the process has just been very interesting, switching from club to club to club. Eagle Sticks is a very predominantly successful club originating out of Atlanta. There are kids that drive all the way from Chattanooga, Tennessee to come to these practices.
It's intense.
Wow.
I mean, and they're twice a week during the school year.
Talk about some gas money. Goodness gracious.
Yeah. I mean, and then they play in these tournaments up north. And surprisingly, for some of these tournaments, they get their butt kicked. But, I mean, in other opportunities, they're ranked 10th in the nation. That's pretty impressive for being a Southern-based girls lacrosse team. And so it's mostly based out of Milton, which is a feeder team into Milton High School, which is one, at least for women's lacrosse, I believe as of last year, I can't remember who they played, but they've won 15 GHSA 7A state championship games.
Yeah, Milton is that team.
They're a powerhouse.
That's insane.
At least for women's lacrosse, for girls lacrosse. And so the popularity of girls lacrosse transitioning into a women's Division I team has actually become a really big topic of conversation. I know Clemson just added a Division I team, or they're adding a class of 2024 team this next coming year. And they're recruiting directly out of Georgia.
Yeah, and it's just, like you were saying, starting at the younger level, elementary, middle, they work their way up, get really good by the time they hit high school, and then the next generation in elementary school sees good high school players. It just constantly grows and grows. Then they go to college, whether it's club or D1 or whatever.
Right.
But I think you mentioned Clemson, and we asked a big question we asked to all the female players that me and Wynn interviewed was, would you want that? Like, straight up, like, going back to that third point of the three-part test, would you want right now or next season, whatever, to be transitioned into a varsity level sport? And they were kind of, how would you describe it? I'd say they were kind of indifferent on it.
Really?
Like, they were kind of eh. And we were both kind of confused by that at first. And
it was the most neutral opinion I could have ever seen.
They were kind of like, we'd like it, but also kind of not. And after their explanation, I kind of get it. And what their main point of not going to that level was, they like the leadership that they get. Mm-hmm. Like, Delaney and Caitlin, they pretty much run things. They rarely have coaches come out. They schedule their own games. They schedule hotels. They manage all the money, and they have an exec and all that. So they like kind of the self-leadership. Mm-hmm. But what they would like, and Wynn was saying this earlier, was more appreciation just from the university. We've mentioned it already, but their success, they would just like some kind of shout-out, some kind of recognition, even though they are a club sport. So they brought up Clemson. They brought up a few other schools. Their one concern was them losing leadership and also who they would play. Like, they'd be part of the SEC. I think that's how that would work.
Yeah.
But, I mean, wouldn't they play Kennesaw? If that would be like a scrimmage game or something.
Right, like, because I don't know if any other SEC school has a D1 women's program. So they would,
Vanderbilt, I think, does.
Vandy, okay.
Yeah.
But besides that, I mean, would they have to be considered independent when it comes to competition?
That's a good question.
That is a good question. And something at least that what y'all were hitting on about how it was kind of indifferent, wasn't it, and correct me if I'm wrong, when Georgia's club women's lacrosse team went and played BC
in the national championship for the WCLA. Yep.
Yeah. Yes. Weren't three or four of BC's starters former Division I girls that went down to the club level? Because I thought I saw an article on that somewhere, but
that is completely likely and sounds like it probably is a thing because it's BC and probably, but I'm not sure, but you know.
That's a really popular thing in the men's lacrosse. When I was talking to Riley Walker, the president of the club team here, he was saying over half their team are guys that have left D1 teams and just come to Georgia just to be a student and then play club lacrosse.
Like our two people, Delaney and Caitlin.
He said, honestly, he was like, the two things I love about it are, one, the leadership, like he said, I get to decide. Me and our, like, board, which is like him, the vice president, and like a donor, basically, get to decide what they do for everything. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I don't have to talk to a coach about it. Like, the coach shows up for practice and games and gives us film, and that's it.
Yeah.
And then he also said he was like balancing. He was like, being at a D1 school playing lacrosse, it's a job. And he was like, now I get to actually be a student and enjoy my life and all that kind of stuff. And so that, I mean, I can definitely see why the hesitation on going to transitioning your program from a club to a varsity level sport.
Caitlin also mentioned the idea of having both, like keeping the club, but also introducing a new D1 team so that people who wanted, like, older students could keep their leadership while also kind of transitioning, not immediate switch, which... Yeah. That could be a good solution if they want it.
With like here at Georgia, club baseball. There's club baseball.
Yeah.
One of my best friends is the president for that. And then you got the varsity baseball team too.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And for you, Audrey, you did swimming.
Yes.
Right. So kind of hit on a little bit about the difference between, you know, club swimming, varsity swimming. What does that look like and that kind of thing?
Well, there's a lot of similarities, at least from what y'all have been talking about with club lacrosse to club swimming. I mean, the entire team is... They have no coach. So it's entirely student run. There's an executive board with, and there's a girl named, I'm going to butcher her last name, but Georgia Briesk. And so she's the current president. In all of that, they have their executive board that does scheduling for meets, hotel rooms, travel, all of the extra expenses. All the students, they all pay, I think, dues that are $35 for the year.
That's it?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's impressive. And can we also just acknowledge, you know, how impressive it is for everyone, you know, these college students to be able to put all that together, you know, being able to make all the accommodations. It's unreal. Well,
so, sorry to interrupt you real quick. That's what one of the things that Riley was saying about the club lacrosse president is, he was like, this is one of the best resume boosters I could have, especially he's applying for vet school, and he's like, they absolutely loved that I was the president of this because I have to handle everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it makes really good sense.
It's a big time commitment. For sure.
I'm amazed that they can squeeze that much out of $35. I mean, I guess they have a lot of swimmers.
They're the largest club sport at the university. Mm-hmm. They have over 207 swimmers.
Oh, see, there it is.
Which is massive. It is huge. And so with their
The dues go down.
I mean, yeah. And so the cool thing is, at least, because I talked to Aiden Rickaby, and he's their finance guy for Club Swim. It's just been very interesting for them. Yes, like, the price has increased for them, at least in the most, like, recent year. But inflation, obviously, has caused a lot of, you know, things are just more expensive generally. And the sport itself has just been really cool for Aiden and the rest of the executive board to monitor and kind of just be a part of, because they started, a lot of their stories is swimming is popular in Georgia. There are massive club teams that have done tremendous work in building up schools, at least in the state of Georgia. Georgia Tech, really great swim program. SEC schools like Georgia and Auburn, Florida, really great swim programs. Lots of Olympians coming out of them, and people will even come from, you know, programs out west to come to Georgia for that. But at least what y'all have been talking about from club to Division One, there have been a lot of swimmers that have actually gone from Division One to club instead. So,
which mirrors the lacrosse.
Exactly, exactly. So Kat Nyman for UJ Club Swim is the prime example of that. She is a junior national record holder, or she's qualified for junior nationals, has been competing in the 200 breaststroke, 100 breaststroke against nationally ranked swimmers who have also qualified for Olympic trials cuts and stuff like that. And she originally was a swimmer at Georgia Southern. And she started her freshman year during COVID, thought that that was what she wanted. And the more and more she got into the sport, she realized, like, this is a lot. There's a lot of high demands. The coach is not what she was expecting. The experience is not what she wanted. And even though being at a school that has, it's in the South and having a football team, she realized that there were other opportunities elsewhere. And surprisingly, she'd heard about the UJ club team. And honestly, that was her reason to transfer. One, UJ also had her major here. And two, the fact that the club team is really good. And so,
and what school was she at before transferring?
Georgia Southern.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, she's just a prime example of people switching from Division One. At least her, another third reason for her was also mental health. And mental health in the sport of swimming is surprisingly a big issue. Like, lots of people are starting to refocus their center on mental health in the sport. There's been a girl that I was friends with in high school that did club swim and ended up going and swimming at Louisville, and she stepped away from the sport. Like, there are, it's a growing number of people at the Division I level that are starting to step away, but more and more people at like the high school and club level starting to really pick it up, because it, as both Aiden and Kat have said, it's a lifetime sport. You can swim for the rest of your life. You don't have, like, and honestly, when you can't swim, you can just float. Like, it's a great opportunity to just, like, get active, get in the water, and even when you're not swimming at, you know, the highest level, you can still do it.
Yeah, and, you know, you're talking about the emphasis on mental health. I don't want to take this away from, you know, apply this to every single person, but a club sport, obviously, when you're comparing to a varsity sport, I'd have to say one of the main differences is just the, you know, the strain that it takes on you when it's not a varsity sport. You know, a club sport, really, I feel like, really emphasizes the enjoyment of what you're doing, the true activity behind it, instead of the implications of, you know, record, everything that really comes with it at the same time.
And you can put however much you want into it. That's kind of what we've been saying this entire time, and you were mentioning this with men's lacrosse. People can be very talented and could maybe go to the D1 level, but they want to enjoy other aspects of their life, and they find a good balance. Like what you're saying with mental health, I don't know as much as you do when it comes to swimming at the high school and club and D1 level, but Michael Phelps is a huge example. I mean, he's been very advocate about, you know, he's had drinking problems and suicide, and that's more of, I think, Olympics mental issues than swimming, but obviously they both combine into that.
Here's a little nugget that I found out from one of my just people that I know is actually really good friends with him. And it's one of his mentors, and it's an older gentleman. Rumor is that Michael Phelps might be getting back in the pool.
Really?
Yeah.
I have heard that.
You've heard it here first, outside of what Audrey just said. She's heard it as well. But Ryland with the answers. So
potentially.
Yeah.
Like at the Olympic level?
Yeah.
The rumor mill is swirling.
Apparently he's been in the pool every single day, and he's trying to get back to.
Good for him.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I'm sure after his struggle, he's able to go back and work out the kinks of mentally and stuff.
But also, is that an impact of only doing one thing for your whole life?
That's a great question.
Like, do you want it to be a lifetime sport?
Yeah, I mean, right. being a Division I athlete, at what point do you realize, okay, I think I'm going to go pro, or am I just going to stop and try and figure out a job? And so I think that's why at least Kat Nyman thought, like, okay, you know, Georgia has the major that I want. I'm going to step away from Division I and do club because I'm actually going to enjoy the sport and get to compete with friends and people that really lift me up, instead of, you know, pouring all of her effort into something that maybe she may not even qualify for trials for, with, like, you know, what are the odds of that?
Right.
Have you guys seen the, sorry to go off topic a little bit, have you seen the recent interview that came out with Andrew Luck?
No.
So, it might have been, I think it was on ESPN, and they did a feature on him, and he was kind of opening up about his decision to end football early, just focus on being a husband and all that kind of stuff and just living his life. And he talked about how hard it was and how much counseling he had to go through to be able to separate from doing one thing his entire life to transition to something else. And it took him like 3 to 4 years, he said, because the mental strain that he went through for 8, 9, 10 years, he was so used to it and his brain got addicted to doing that it took so long for him to be able to back away from it and
mental memory, just like almost being like a robot, just constantly. So,
well, I mean, you focus your life around one thing for a decade, and you know, it's really hard to turn from one to the other.
Yeah.
It's exactly what I'm sure he's been doing and trying to get reaffiliated with.
Kind of bringing it back to us, I think club sports, like we said, brings a great alternative because you can kind of cut the time in half, still enjoy the sport, and then here at UGA have a heck of a time.
Yeah. And that kind of brings up the last point we'll cover, and that's recruiting. And, you know, recruiting, there's been a lot of recruiting rules implemented at the D1 and club level, just rules involving coaches being able to talk to middle school and high schoolers and how early they can and whatever else. Talk about a little bit your recruiting process, and we'll kind of compare it to what we've heard at the club level.
Well, football is a whole different animal.
Right.
The king of all recruiting, if you will.
4-star. Rylan Goedy.
Straight out of Kennesaw.
Stop it. I think the biggest thing that it comes down to, and with talking with the coach from Reinhardt and Coach Whittemore, who is the head coach at Missouri State, who was actually the assistant at Reinhardt, is it all just comes down to money. He was like, club sports, oftentimes there's really no financial aid there. He's like, but with NAIA schools, like, we don't have any restrictions on scholarship amounts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. And so you go D1, you can get this amount. D2 is even less. D3 is even less. And then NAIA is like everyone for himself. So if they can find the money for you, they'll give it to you. And so that's one of the big things in recruiting for them. And then obviously for a varsity level like football, it's all just about,
there's way too many variables, relationships,
and school. And there's also, what you got to think about too is different sports provide different amount of scholarship money. So football is a complete scholarship. Everything's paid for. You go to a varsity baseball team, you've got 35 guys that have to split 11 scholarships. And so, and then you go to lacrosse and it's even less. And so you just got to, you know, figure that out.
And it's interesting at the club level because they obviously are a club and aren't going to give out scholarships. So, I mean, I think a lot of recruiting, at least for the women's lacrosse side, is we get UGA as a university gets a lot of their student body from the north anyway. So students either aren't aware that they even have a club team, or a couple of students we talked to said they came here looking at the club team and wanted that balance. Mm-hmm. What were your eyes just raised? What's up?
Okay, so I was shooting something at a hotel like a couple weeks ago, and like all of a sudden there's this mom and two daughters walking in through the lobby, and I'm like standing there with my camera, and they were asking me a couple questions about the school and whatever, and I was really excited to talk to them. And all of a sudden this girl said, oh my gosh, yeah, you know, we just met with Delaney Ott today.
Perfect.
And
full circle.
Yeah, yeah, it was a really full circle moment. So she was telling me about how this girl goes, she plays in Maryland and came down to Georgia. She's a sophomore in high school and is looking at UGA just to, you know, potentially go here, but had previously talked with Delaney about coming and playing lacrosse here. And so I just think it's very interesting to see the full circle moment of how the recruiting of lacrosse really is large on the club level at UGA.
And we can never underestimate the power of social media, the influence that it holds on mm-hmm. that generation, obviously our generation as well. You know, the Women's Club Lacrosse Instagram page really holds a lot of weight when it comes to, you know, attracting, you know, the girls in high school who are really interested in making this a club or sport, you know, making mm-hmm. it an interest for their college career. So I think that's really something that, you know, we can't really just shy away from. It's a huge factor in the recruitment for these players.
Right. And at least something very interesting from what I've seen in regards to recruiting. So the UGA men, the UGA Division One swim team recently has split into men and women's.
I heard about that.
And it's a brand new divide. So I think that definitely will play into Title IX now having two separate teams rather than just one. They have completely separate team managers, two separate coaches, especially with the recent, you know, and I'm blanking on his name, but they're
retiring.
Yeah. Yes, the retiring head coach. And
Jack.
Yes, Jack Bowerly. Yes. So Jack Bowerly has left the university. And so now having two new coaches come in for both men and women's has definitely, I think that'll be an interesting shift into how the team competes.
And we talked about this a little in class, just out of curiosity. Remind me again, is that an in-house thing or is everyone in the SEC / NCAA doing that? Like splitting men and women?
I don't know. I didn't do enough research on that, but I can.
Because if they're still meeting together, co-ed, then it might just be like a managerial in-house, mm-hmm. like they're just trying to take advantage of resources type thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it still could introduce things with Title IX and possibilities. Like the entire women's team could be together practicing, and if a student is touring and sees that, you know, that might mm-hmm. that makes a difference.
I think their practice times are still at the same time, but they compete. They swim at like lanes are divided.
Okay.
So men are on one side, women are on the other. And they have separate team managers. They travel. They think they've always traveled separate. They always take two buses, just even when they were co-ed team. But I think it, in regards to points, they compete individually for points. And that's also on a GHSA level. Like, at least mm-hmm. when I was swimming in high school, we didn't win overall. Like, we didn't win, or Alpharetta High School did not win the overall state championship on the 6A level simply because we were two divided teams. We were men and women's teams. And so women got third, men got first.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And there was another team that outscored us by like X amount of points because the teams were separated.
Right.
And so combined, we would have won, but because we weren't combined, we didn't, unfortunately.
Interesting. Well, I think kind of to sum everything up, sports for men and women, I think, is definitely on the rise, lacrosse and swimming wise. I think, you know, we're definitely turning a new leaf as far as Title IX goes and including women and giving them opportunities that they, you know, well deserve and, you know, should have had from the beginning. I think we're definitely making a turn there. And
the question remains, not to interrupt you, Ryan, the question remains for women's lacrosse especially, is it something they actually want to do? We'd have to go out and conduct a mass study to see everyone's
step three
interest in those. Yeah,
that'd actually be pretty interesting to see. That'd be really cool.
Next mission up. That's our next assignment.
Like, I guess, you know, like the sport of swimming is growing just in general. Like the numbers are definitely increasing, but I think what is something more notable is the diversity in the sport itself. Like 10 years ago, there was not, I mean, the number has grown from, at least since 2012, the percentage of non-white swimmers have grown from 18% to 26%.
Wow.
And these numbers are near identical to Division I men swimming, which is quite interesting. So both in men and women's Division I swimming, the diversity is increasing, which is definitely something that is really great and is going to benefit a lot of these programs in the long run.
Wow, that's really cool. I didn't know that. That's a really good stat.
And I mean, like tying into the whole Olympics thing, there are a lot of former and current swimmers or just like Olympic athletes that are really tying into or really like finding their own voice through their platform, especially with the use of social media to amplify like the diversity of their sport. And so that was something at least that on the club level has just been really interesting to see. There was a girl that I spoke to on the club team that basically said that, like, a lot of these coaches are predominantly, like, white male coaches. And a lot of these swimmers, at least with regard to access of pools and places to compete, they're, at least at UGA, a lot of these like, so ABSC, Athens Bulldog Swim Club, kids will travel from like 30, 45 minutes away just to come to these practices. And Ramsey's just become like a great hub for a great pool, great facilities, and really great coaching, at least in the past like a couple years. And these swimmers are really starting to love it. And being able to have coaches that reflect the population has really encouraged a lot of these swimmers to come and join this club, which has been really sweet to see the growth of.
Yeah, I guess. So it's fair to say that men's lacrosse, women's lacrosse, and swimming on the male and female level are all starting from like the elementary school level up to Olympic level. They're all kind of growing, which is interesting.
Georgia sports continues to be on the rise in all facets.
Thank you to our listeners. That is all.